If you've ever looked at a biology textbook and wondered who drew the diagrams of blood cells, or wondered how someone figured out what a dinosaur's muscles and skin should look like, well, today's Please Explain is for you. We will look into how images help scientists and lay people alike understand complex ideas. A judge for the annual Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge and a former challenge winner, join us now. Felice Frankel is a senior research fellow at Harvard University, Faculty of Arts and Sciences in the initiative in innovative computing. And Graham Johnson is a certified medical illustrator and NSF pre-doctoral fellow at the Scripps Research Institute. A little later, they'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Hello.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
So what exactly is a scientific visualization?
Do I take it or does
Yeah,
they...
you might as well, Felice.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to start in a weird tone in the sense that I have a problem with the word visualization.
Oh, I was planning to use it about 1,000 times.
I'm sure you were. And that is what, for the most part, the science community does use, that term. I think in terms of what people ordinarily see it as, it is a means of visually expressing data and concepts. It could be a graph. It could be the stunningly beautiful drawings that Graham makes. It could even be a photograph that I sometimes have the luxury of making. My problem with the word visualization is that sometimes it doesn't communicate, and for that reason, I try to use the word visual expression. But, you know, just humor me a little bit, but you could use any word you want.
Well, you're a judge for the Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge, so should we change it to the Science and Engineering Visual Expression Challenge?
Yes, to tell you the truth, I'm working on it. My NSF colleagues get angry at me, but yet they do see the point in a way, because communication is a serious part of what we're trying to do when we express something. And sometimes there are some pretty brilliant computer scientists who come up with all these extraordinary algorithms to express data, but I have no clue what in the world it's all about. So I very much want to instill that notion of communication. So there it is. There's my silly little soapbox.
And in some cases, scientists have to visualize before they can come up with the algorithms or the other kinds of equations.
It's a very good point, and it goes both ways. Yes, you're right. Sometimes they have to visualize it in their minds, but that's sort of an explanatory kind of visualization. But then there's another kind that is let's call it exploratory, in the sense of they have so much data. That's what's happening in the genome project, for example. Gobs and gobs of data, and how in the world are we supposed to find a way to understand it? So the idea is that the visualization itself clarifies what it is that we are in fact looking at. So it goes both ways.
Graham, do different subjects require the use of different media? For example, why would you use illustrations instead of photography for your work on cells and synapses?
For this particular subject matter, the majority of what we're looking at has a variety of sort of abstract techniques to visualize what is otherwise impossible to see. And as an illustrator, people in my field have to bring all this data together into a concrete visualization of what we think these things look like. And as the data collecting techniques improve, we find out we're either right or wrong, but it's a bringing together theories, different modes of visualization, and raw biochemical, biophysical data.
So you're making things up to some degree. You're guessing, and you're making a picture of your guesstimate?
In my particular field, we do a lot of educated guesswork. It's more that there are strong theories supported by abstract data that's difficult to visualize directly, and we bridge that gap to make sense of all these things in a way that that other people can rapidly interpret, instead of having to put together the information that's in a graph as well as the information that's in an electron micrograph that might be a little bit hazy, as well as the information that's in a more detailed crystallographic structure. We're able to bring those all together into one place to tell a story.
Well, how much visual interpretation is done by the artist when he or she is making a scientific image? I've always wondered about when images are colorized, whether it's cells or a far-off galaxy. Who decides what should be red and what should be blue and what should be yellow?
Well, that's a very important question, I'll throw it over to Graham in a second, but I wanted to just say that please remember that both of us are basically re-presenting ideas and data. The visualization is never the thing. There's always some sort of translation or interpretation involved. Even the nature of framing the image or the drawing is an interpretation, but it does come with education, just as the Hubble, this incredible space, these space images, yes, they are colorized, but they're colorized with not just for an aesthetic reason, but for a communicative piece. That is, they color certain gases, for example. It's not any old way of coloring it. They have a reason for coloring them a certain way.
So they assign colors,
yes,
to different things?
That's exactly right. There's an educated purpose for the colorization. It's not just making pretty pictures.
But if I were there, if I were closer to that event, in some far-off galaxy, I might not see those gases in that color.
You would not, because a lot of this information, by the way, is not optical in the sense that we cannot see the wavelengths. So sometimes you have these amazing Hubble images that are basically captured with infrared, and which we can't see. So you remember, we only see a very small portion of the spectrum, and that's something that's difficult for a lot of us to comprehend because we're self-centered in a way, but there's a lot that we are not able to see, at least with our eyes, but we can sense them with instruments, and we then interpret that data by using various color palettes.
Well, how does that apply to the photographs that you take, often on extremely small scales? Are there some things that are just too small to photograph?
Sure. I mean, well, remember, the word photograph itself means light, and there are things that are smaller than the wavelength of light. So, for example, when we look at stuff that are considered on the nano level, which is much, much smaller than light waves, then we have to use electrons to see, and that's in quotes. But of course, when we use an electron microscope, we're really collecting numbers that are eventually processed into an image. So once again, there's always some sort of translation involved. You've obviously done your homework, because I think it's a good question, at least in my field. But I wanted to say that when we do capture with electrons, it is in grayscale, and sometimes some of us color those images. We are mucking around in a way with the data, but we always, and this is really important, we always tell the reader that we are doing something to the image. That is the distinction between a science image maker and an artist.
My guests are Felice Frankel and Graham Johnson. And we thought we were talking about visualizations on Please Explain, but we're actually talking about visual expression. Graham, how different are artistic thinking and scientific thinking? Are most of the artists who create visualizations, do they think of themselves as scientists, or are they artists who are interested in science?
I think the people in my particular field are a fairly unique group that have artistic talent and the other side of their brain working to be able to comprehend and function in the scientific world as well. But I also do see within the research community a number of talented, maybe frustrated artists performing as much interpretive work or illustrative work that they can. They really look forward to an opportunity to publish so that they can do an editorial illustration for a cover, for example, which has a little bit more artistic freedom than the raw data that they're presenting within the structure of their paper.
Last weekend, the American Museum of Natural History's new permanent exhibition on human origins opened, and they had dioramas. And I understand that the new models have flies on their shoulders, or they're shown in situations where attacks from predators are imminent. These are decisions that are being made as to what kinds of scientific visual expressions we should be subjected to.
Yeah, again, there is some sort of subjective decision made. And for the museum, they want to communicate. Yes, so they've made a decision to add that. I haven't seen it yet, but it certainly makes sense because it becomes perhaps more real to the viewer and the experiencer.
How long has this been happening? When were, I'm going to use the word visualizations, first used to help advance scientific ideas? I think of Leonardo da Vinci, but it must have happened earlier than that.
Well, Galileo, of course, made these pretty amazing observations that people look at as art. Wouldn't you say, Graham, that, you know, it's that distinction, I'm not sure where it begins and where it ends with that kind of stuff. But sure, I mean, any kind, if you even look at the caves in, I forget the name, I'm embarrassed that I don't remember the name in France, 35,000 years ago, they created these glorious, and I'll say it, visualizations of buffalo, and why not consider that as a scientific expression?
Did Einstein do drawings before he came up with the equations? I know Richard Feynman did diagrams.
Yes. I believe, Graham, do you want to take that? Because I
honestly don't know. My understanding would be that he sort of did the visualization in his head with his thought experiments. But
that's my understanding, too.
Well, are there some scientific concepts that can only be communicated as images?
Well, certainly when you want to show evidence of a structure, let's say within a cell, it seems to me that the way to show that is in fact by capturing that structure and showing it as an image. I'll also say that I'm privileged to have conversations with Benoit Mandelbrot. I don't know if your listeners would know of the Mandelbrot set, those amazing fractals, for example. I gather that Benoit didn't even think of it until he saw the image itself, that the image made with the algorithm then after that brought on the mathematics. So, you know, it goes both ways.
I think a really good example is crystallographic structure. The data comes out as just an enormous list of numbers. They're 3D XYZ coordinates. And for somebody to try to digest those numbers and interpret them into sort of a tangible structure and understand how that structure interacts with another structure, like you can picture a pair of hands shaking, just understanding that as a list of thousands of numbers would be impossible. But you translate that into three-dimensional reconstruction, and you've got what is interpreted as a solid protein structure, and you can start to understand the function from these just by looking at their shapes.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation about visual expression as part of today's Please Explain with Brooklyn's own Felice Frankel, a senior research fellow at Harvard University, faculty of Arts and Sciences in the Initiative in Innovative Computing, and also Graham Johnson, a certified medical illustrator and NSF predoctoral fellow at the Scripps Research Institute. And we invite your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And we are back with Please Explain and with Graham Johnson and Felice Frankel. And we're talking about visual expressions of scientific concepts, which help us to understand some of these really complicated ideas. Sometimes they're pretty straightforward. In other cases, a lot of ingenuity has to go into making them comprehensible to us all. We invite your calls at 212-433-9692. And let's go to the first caller, Christine from New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well.
Well, I have to say, thanks for taking my call. I'm a huge fan, but you made me cringe when you said you're guessing, because I am, too, a medical illustrator and a medical animator. And I've trained for 20 years side by side with surgeons and scientists and researchers. And it's not all guessing. It's.
I didn't say it was. He said that in some cases he was trying to put things together, and I was thinking, well, that was an educated. That means an educated guess.
Yes,
where we don't know.
Educated is the key word.
Okay.
No, it's you know, Graham's very, spoken very eloquently about our profession, and I've gone through the similar training as he has in the specific schools throughout the United States. It's a very niche group of people who kind of do this for a living, and we're all very dedicated to, you know, keeping the education process going through art and animation and visualization and visual expression, as I'm learning to use that term today.
Now, looking over our callers, a number of them are also involved in this field in one way or another.
Well, I listed this call on our web server today, so hopefully all over the country, people, medical illustrators all over are listening to you.
Well, any number of them are women. Do you think that women are more likely to get into this area if they're interested in the sciences?
No, I think it's pretty 50-50. There's, I think, 4 schools in the United States that do this on a master's level, and they're pretty small groups that graduate. And I went to U of I at Chicago for biomedical visualization, and I think there were 12 of us in that graduating class, and it was very 50-50. And they go into numerous fields. Some people go into prosthetics. Some people go into animation. Some people go into, you know, more traditional illustration. I started out in illustration at Sloan Kettering, and then slowly, you know, graduated into the world of 3D visualization.
Now, Graham, do you feel good that somebody came to your defense?
I feel great, because I want to make sure that I properly represent the field, and Christine just did a great job explaining it. So,
thank you, Christine. Felice, what about women in the field? When you were going to public school in Brooklyn, did you...
How did you know that? Did I tell somebody that?
We have visualized it. We have visualized it. Were you thinking about going to the sciences?
Oh, I was in the sciences, absolutely. In fact, at PS 92 on Rogers and Bedford, I wrote in my sixth grade album, I'm probably talking to people, maybe there are a couple of you who understand this address book we used to put together.
Well, it's right near the Washington Temple, actually, one of the
All
most
right.
famous churches
All right.
in Brooklyn.
I wrote that I was going to, what are you going to be when you grow up? And I wrote that I was going to be a chemist. So that was, I can't even tell you how long ago, maybe 55 years ago, something like that. So I did, in fact, study science in college and in biology and chemistry. And I think I want to make the point that I think one of the reasons why this works for me and Graham, I'm speaking for you, Graham, you'll tell me if I'm wrong, is that we love science. I think it's an important part of what we're doing. I don't I don't make images that cannot be made. In other words, Graham is using his data and his imagination to come up with something. I actually make something that can be captured. But at the same time, if I could bring up this other piece, what about all those very talented illustrators who are making visualizations, of things that we can't see, like, for example, stuff going on the quantum level? That's where you do have to guess a little more, let's say, than the medical people do.
Let's go to another call. Letitia from Queens. Hi. You're on. Please explain.
Hi, how are you?
Well.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a college student. I go to Hunter College, the University of New York, and I'm a biology major. I find that it's extremely helpful to have those illustrations in the textbook. I find that if you have a teacher, if you happen to have a teacher that can't explain the concepts, you know, you can always rely on the textbook. Sometimes you don't even have to come to class to learn it because you can just go to the text and it will be so much more well explained to you. And I also find that it's very, it helps decentralize the information in the sense that you don't have to rely on the teachers. And I find that I'm getting, if I'm motivated, I can get very good instruction. I don't need to go to, you know, any Ivy League college or any of that. I can have the access to the same kind of information. So I find it extremely helpful to have those graphics in the textbooks.
Well, thank you so much for your call. That's why you do it, isn't it?
It's always great to hear, yes.
Okay, we go now to Tony from Brooklyn. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I just pledged, so you should be thanking me.
I was
curious to ask your guest if there's ever an example where, you know, visualizing these concepts that are sometimes really complicated might serve as a detriment to kind of a more complex or nuanced understanding.
You mean simplifying, you know, too much?
What was that?
Simplifying it too much?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. We have this tendency in contemporary culture. I come from a, you know, contemporary art background, so I'm thinking a lot about the popular image and stuff. And so, you know, if you think about war images, you know, a lot of times war photographs, they simplify, you know, sort of package and sterilize a very complex, gritty idea or, you know, experience. So in the same way, I was curious to know if, you know, perhaps images ever serve to the detriment of a complex idea.
You want to begin, Graham?
Sure. I can think of two things right off the top of my head. I mean, first, you can certainly forge information or dangerously misinterpret information, present that, it becomes accepted. There's numerous examples, especially in my niche of cell biology and molecular biology, where a structure of a particular protein has been drawn incorrectly for years, and it's only recently that everyone has new technologies that allow them to correct that. But, you know, people are basing their understanding of their research on such misinterpretation, so that's dangerous. And also, there's been a lot of oversimplification in this particular niche again, where they didn't know what these structures looked like for years, and so things were drawn as circles and triangles, and now we can actually see what their shapes are. And a chemist, for example, can hold a protein on their computer screen or a physical model like we print in our labs in their hands and see the little pocket where a drug should bind, and they can fit different structures into that, different drug structures, just like puzzle pieces to try and create better chemical interactions, for example.
Can't prejudices or ideologies sometimes seep into models of things, like in the evolutionary diagrams in the past where the drawing showed human ancestors getting progressively lighter skinned as modern humans developed?
Definitely. We're on the cutting edge. And theories are turned over all the time, but they're presented as theories and they're supported or debunked by peer-reviewed journals. So none of this is written in stone yet. For anatomy and physiology, it's a little more concrete. It's been illustrated for hundreds of years, but for these newer technologies, these newer sciences, I think there's a lot of room for error. But it's scientists are pretty cautious about making those great leaps. So,
but Leonard, you bring up, I think, a very important point, and that is how powerful an image can be. That evolutionary image that you just described is something that people have in their minds, and yet it is not correct, is it? Nor is the tip. Remember, we used to look at the Atomic Energy Commission icon of the atom. Well, it's not as simple as that. It's not about a ball of electrons going around in an ellipse.
It isn't?
Oh gosh, no! I'm afraid not. Isn't that awful? But
well, you know, these things we study them in school, and yeah, the image stays with us the rest of our life until somebody tells us, "Hey, that's no longer true."
And you know what? Even if they tell you it's no longer true, it doesn't matter. It's so this is a problem. Seriously, it is so powerful. Images, that is, that it doesn't even matter if somebody tells you differently. If I could just, one other thing in regard to the simplification, which is your caller is bringing up a really important point. My dilemma is that I'm sort of part of this notion of let's make something more communicative by simplifying, yet at the same time when you do that, you're misinforming. I mean, this cell is unbelievably complicated, isn't it, Graham? I mean, he knows that. There's so much stuff going on in there, and to draw it as a simple design, inferring, Frank, perhaps, that there could be something designing it is destructive. If people could only have an idea of how messed up that cell is, it wouldn't feel as perfect as some people think it is.
So the illustrators are the only real intelligent designers, you're saying?
Yes, you got it.
Let's take another call. Barbara from Manhattan. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Oh, hi. This is a very important program having to do with communication and truth, I must say. I wanted to share with you some definitions, two of them, about the relation of science and art by Eli Segal, the American poet and founder of aesthetic realism. It's right on the point. One of them, the simplest or most poetic, I guess, is science is exactitude gone for passionately, while art is passion had exactly.
Does that make sense to you, Graham?
I'm contemplating.
Well, maybe it was.
It does, yeah.
Poetry sometimes also finds another dimension, doesn't it? It takes us to other places. But in this case, do you see the art as serving the science? When you're doing something, Felice talked about all the stuff you have to leave out sometimes to make something clear. That's a case of art both serving the science, but also perhaps serving the story that's being told. You might take all the stuff that you left out and put it into a different drawing to tell a different story.
Right. And that's, I guess that gets to the heart of illustrators. People ask why not just use photographs, even in human anatomy, when things are on a scale that you can easily photograph them, and it's our job to pull out pertinent information and subdue the ancillary information so that we can tell a story, a particular story.
Let's take another call. Fernando from Trumbull, Connecticut.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Fernando.
I was thinking that one visualization, which is very important in order to understand Einstein's positivism, is the example of the man in the elevator, in which the elevator is being accelerated. Someone shines a ray of light through a hole in the wall, and the person in the elevator cannot distinguish that from the force of gravity acting on light.
Felice?
Yeah, that's an example of how there's no way that a photographer could take a picture of this phenomenon. So, right? So it is a metaphor. This whole notion of creating metaphor, visual metaphors to explain phenomena, is very exciting. By the way,
I've seen that done as a film.
Yeah,
that's another way you can do. Yeah. You can visualize these things. You can do an animation, or you could just have a film. I think I saw once the same thing with a man in a trolley, and I still was a little confused because I have such an unscientific mind, but it made it a lot easier for me to grasp.
Yeah, it's a means of a handle of some sort. But one of the things that I wanted to raise with this is that the very nature of thinking about how to visualize it is a very powerful teaching tool. And we're developing a program that gets students to find ways of visually expressing ideas in science. And it's a means of, you know, talking with each other about, you know, this doesn't work so well because X, Y, and Z. I'm curious, actually, when you do your really stunning images, do you have conversations with people as you draw? Do people say, you know, this isn't quite right or whatever?
Definitely. Depending on how new the concept is, especially, we'll go through a series of sketches back and forth and sometimes bring in extra content experts. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a bit about the Synapse Revealed, which won first place in illustration in the 2005 Science and Engineering Visualization Challenge?
Sure. That's a good example of a piece where a fair amount of simplification had to be incorporated. I did quite a bit of research. The editors of this journal came to me, Howard Hughes Medical Institute Journal, Bulletin, and they just asked me to create what's called an editorial illustration. It summarizes the content of an entire article, and it's written sort of for general audiences. So I did a bunch of research to find out what the microscopic anatomy of these interactions looked like, and there's a good deal of 3D reconstructions, and it showed that it's incredibly complex. So I had to reduce the number of interacting cells to be able to tell the story in a way that could be interpreted by the audiences. But we made a point of mentioning that whenever the illustration is presented, that the interactions are reduced, that the image is simplified, and Felice, I guess, might have more to say about it, though.
Well, I just want to say, when I was privileged to be a judge at that point, there was not even a hesitation. His was the best. It was so clearly done, so beautifully done, and the most important piece is that it was highly communicative. So we didn't even have to discuss it. That was a winner, period.
Let's go to one more call. Jen from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Hi, longtime listener, big fan, first-time caller. I'm calling because I'm a dancer and a choreographer, and I find that anatomical drawings are incredibly important and powerful for me. And it's amazing how difficult it is to represent something like a pelvis in 2D. Every time I see a new drawing of a pelvis or another anatomical structure, I find that the way that my body moves literally changes because my understanding changes. And my favorite drawings are actually from Albanus from the late 1600s, early 1700s. They're etchings, and they're just stunningly beautiful. I was curious what your guests thought about the Body Worlds exhibition and in terms of scientific representation.
Well, I'm terribly embarrassed that I have not seen it yet.
I'll speak on that. I've seen it. I think it's fantastic. I mean, there's a lot of controversy about it, but I think that it is making the subject matter interesting to an audience that might not otherwise be concerned about it. So, for people who are not familiar, it's a series of ultra professional dissections done by a German doctor. And then the bodies are plastinated. So we're looking actual dissections of Vesalius drawings, for example, a man holding his own skin in a museum context that you can walk around and explore. But people think it goes a little far when you have a skateboarder doing a hand plant with various organs removed or his skin removed so you can see the different musculature. But I think all of a sudden you're going to bring that content to a new audience of 13-year-old skateboarders who would otherwise just be bored with the exhibits and would plow through. So,
well, thank you so much, Jen. By the way, if you're interested in some of the work that Graham and Felice have done, you'll find links to them on WNYC.org. And my great thanks to both of you for being with us today. Graham Johnson is a certified medical illustrator. Felice Frankel is a senior research fellow at Harvard University Faculty of Arts and Sciences. It's been a great Please Explain. I learned a lot.
Excellent. So did I.
Thanks for having us on.
You bet.